Welcome to the GeoMob Podcast, where we discuss geo-innovation in any and all forms, be it for fun or profit.
Welcome to another GeoMob Podcast. Today, it's a fantastic pleasure to welcome my, I'm going to say old friend, because I've known Mookie Hackley for 20 years now, when we first met at Ordnance Survey at an event there. So Mookie is a professor of geographical information science at UCL. His bio says, I've been involved in R&D of geographical information systems and geospatial technologies since 1988. I've carried out both industrial and academic research. At UCL, I've started a research group, Extreme Citizen Science, and grown it to 20 researchers, as well as co-founding a social enterprise. Mookie has also been a phenomenal friend to GeoMob. When we first started GeoMob, he was the one who said, I can find you space at UCL. And for many years, UCL was our first home. Nowadays, we spend more time at the Geovation Hub, but we still get back to UCL at least once a year. And we never forget the home that Mookie gave to us when we were starting out. So Mookie, thank you for GeoMob. Welcome to the podcast. I don't know why it's taken me 2 years or more to get you on this podcast. You should have been at the front of the list. So welcome to the podcast, Mookie.
Thank you so much. It's such a pleasure. It was a pleasure to have GeoMob. It was such a fantastic thing from the start to kind of know that you get down from the office and you have all these amazing presentations and chats at the end of the day.
And also, you know, I mean, it was a fabulous mix right from the beginning. You know, we had students of yours from UCL, we had startups, we had established companies. GeoMob has been a fantastic thing for the geo scene in London and now also in Barcelona and Tel Aviv and Munich. You know, it's remarkable that it's kept going, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely amazing.
So, Mookie, let's go back to the beginning. You started out doing hardcore GI stuff academically, and then you've somehow moved along the path somehow to something called citizen science. So before we do anything, just tell us how some of the background of how you got to this citizen science thing.
So I'll go all the way back to what was mentioned in my bio about 88 and kind of starting to do GIS on the kind of second generation PC. We're talking about 286 when you needed the coprocessor 386 to do something with it. And I was actually working on GIS before I went to university. And that meant that I started university as a mature student around 25, and that's in 1991. And I mentioned this year because the point where I started, I was looking for different options. One option was to go to the technical university in Israel, the Technion, for surveying. So that's core kind of geomatic engineering. But they needed me to take an extra year of studies. Or there was an option of joining the Hebrew University, where because of my baccalaureate, I could get into an excellent program. And within this program, I could combine geography and computer science. I was actually the first student to make this combination. And I was told that it's the very odd combination at the time. Like, why would you combine geography and computer science? And then I started doing that and combining those two things together. But the reason I mentioned the year is because in 1992, there is something called a Rio Conference. So people who don't know about it, that's something that was a big international environmental conference, bringing together heads of government and all the rest of it. So the climate change, you can trace it back to that. All kind of other things that connected to the environment, which we see around us today, connected to that. For me, that was a starting point of thinking, I want to use my GIS skills for issues between the environment, society, and how you can use more and more GIS for that purpose. And that's kind of set me up on a path to look more and more into aspects of environment, society. So people, computers, and environment, and how those things interact.
Okay, so now I can see how that leads to citizen science. So for the benefit of the people who don't know, can you explain what citizen science is and why you think it's so important?
Yes. So citizen science is the act of either doing the whole research process or collecting, a lot of time it's collecting environmental data or other types of data by members of the public for the purpose of contributing to a scientific project. A lot of time, this is something where people share the information together. Now, that might sound to you very much like OpenStreetMap. Mm-hmm. And actually, within my classifications and the way that I view the world, actually, OpenStreetMap can be classified as a bottom-up citizen science project. And that should be familiar to a lot of people who are listening right to it. It's something that people are not coming with accreditation or not coming with credential, and they can just take a GPS and start collecting data. Now imagine that you integrate into that also a camera and take pictures of birds, or take an app called iNaturalist, put it on your phone and start picking up the flowers, other wild things that you see around you, and creating a global database of birds, of butterflies, of other things. And the scale of this activity is mind-blowing. Like, for example, during 2021, during the lockdown that was happening, there is an activity that the Royal Society for the Protection of Birds, the RSPB, is carrying out every January. It's called the Big Garden Bird Watch, where it's for educational purpose, and children are encouraged to look out of the window and report the birds that they see in the garden. And the reason that it's mind-blowing is because a million people participated in this activity. That's almost 2% of the population. Now, just imagine that scale would come into things like OpenStreetMap. It's amazing.
But also, presumably, when you get a million people reporting birds in their garden, you're getting a significant statistical sample. Even if some of them are misclassifying and all of that, you're still getting a significant sample, presumably.
Exactly. The same principle that work in OpenStreetMap of multiple people collecting data in the same place and demonstrating the quality this way. The fact that we have in a postcode enough people collecting the observations. So maybe you're not confident about rare birds, but statistics about common birds and other things are very important. And if you go to the RSPB website, you'll see that they are actually identifying trends in bird population and bird distribution from the Big Garden Bird Watch.
And I think, if I remember correctly, there's also a butterfly survey that's done on one day of the year.
Yes.
And I think I've done that butterfly survey, and probably hundreds of thousands of other people do it.
And there is also a project that involves people designing their own activities. So what got me interested was that back even in 1998, I was coming across examples of people in Louisiana who were dealing with a petrochemical factory next door to them, which was polluting the air. And they had a bucket, which is a device that allowed them to use a vacuum cleaner and a plastic bag and collect air samples so they can send it to the laboratory when there is a pollution event, and then the laboratory analyzes that and help them to deal with the pollution or report it to the authorities. So it's got a wide range of activities within it, from things that you do on your computer in the background to going out and collecting data to OpenStreetMap.
And I seem to remember also a group of people around the city airport in East London taking noise measurements and recording noise at different times of the day.
Yeah, indeed. That's something that inspired by this project from Louisiana around 2008 and 2010. We've done the work. Like in 2010, there was an ash cloud that actually stopped flights completely. And that allowed the community to go out and take measurements, which provide the information to demonstrate that there is a difference between regular days and days when there are floods, which is really something that you can't do with modeling or with other sources of information.
Funny, we noticed that during the first most intense period of the COVID lockdown.
Yeah.
You know, we were going out for walks locally and you heard no planes.
Yep.
So is this always geographic, would you say?
It's not always geographic. There is a whole class of citizen science that doesn't involve geography. So you have people, say, doing experiments with DNA in biohacking laboratories. There are people who analyze data about galaxies on their computers, things like that, which are not geographical. But when it comes to environmental data, there is a lot of geography involved. And there is really a big chunk of citizen science which is geographical.
Okay, so do the citizen scientists do the analysis, or are they sort of the data collectors and then another group of professionals or something come in to do the analysis?
It's, again, very similar to OpenStreetMap. So there will be a small group of data collectors who are also interested in the analysis. So, for example, in something called biological recording, so those are ecological observations, people who are interested, say, in ladybirds, or people who are really concerned about specific type of species. You see cases in the UK where people collect the data and even create their own distribution atlases and develop scholarship around the topic. So they are carrying out the whole scientific process around the species. For a lot of people, they are very happy just to collect the data, pass it to scientists so they can do the work with it. Same right. As a lot of mappers in OpenStreetMap.
Right. So this is, I know you're a massive advocate for this, but does it go wrong sometimes?
It can go plenty wrong. So for example, when someone is actually going into the process with the intention of demonstrating something, say a pollution or some problem with the issue, and is not willing to follow what science process is, which is if it doesn't give you the right answer, then that's the answer that you need to rely on. And that's something that, for example, when you're going and work with communities around noise issue, you tell them, we might come out with the wrong answer. And sometimes that kind of create attention and people want to present the data in different ways in order to make the case, but then they shouldn't use the citizen science data. There have been also a case within the climate change area where there was citizen science in order to prove that the scientists are wrong, and weather stations used to be in open space and now they are in built-up area and so on. And the people behind this campaign were, again, unwilling to listen to the scientists who said, yes, we are aware of it, we have calculated in, here are our calculations. So it can lead to different things, and it's not a solution for everything in science. There are also a lot of scientific activities that are not suitable for that, but there is plenty of things where it is.
But I guess we've got enough evidence of professional science where the experiments are designed to prove the prevailing bias or ideas of the scientists. You know, I mean, it's not just citizen science that suffers from that vulnerability. I mean, regular science suffers from it as well, I would say.
Yes, absolutely.
So I've got a question here, because you said you've got 20 researchers doing this. What on earth have you got 20 researchers doing if you've got all these hundreds of thousands of citizen scientists out there? What do the 20 researchers, what are they working on?
Yeah, so one of our leading projects is about creating a citizen science tools and methodologies for people who don't read and write. So we've been working over the past 10 years on creating a tool, a family of tools, mostly software around the name Sapele, which is the name of a tree in the Congo Basin, are supporting community data collection, but can work with indigenous groups. So a lot of the people that are mentioned are actually anthropologists who are going to the field and spending a lot of time, sometimes even a year and a half or 2 years, with a community to learn the language, to learn the practices, to think together about designing a process to collect data that is of interest to the community and address an issue that will work for them and for other actors in the area. Things like dealing with illegal poaching or working with a logging company to mark the areas that will be excluded from logging because they are important local resources, that sort of thing.
Right. So it's a lot of this is going to be about application design that is non-verbal in its interface.
Yes.
Or non-textual.
Non-textual even.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So highly graphical interfaces.
Absolutely. Fully graphical. Some of the, like we have even examples from the Maasai Mara of people recording 300 types of trees in the graphical interface, and the community members are familiar with each of these 300 trees, so they know which one to select when they stand in front of it, and then they can capture, for example, if it's impacted by drought or by, you know, insects or anything else.
So I remember, it must be a decade ago, when you were first starting on this, providing just a little bit of input into a grant application, I think, in the very early stages. But you've been doing this for 10 years. It must have been it kind of all been simple.
Yes, it's not a simple journey to do it within the university context, apart from the raising funding and what funders are actually looking for. So some of the principle of what we followed is to use standard technology, to assume that if you want the technology that can be used in the world, you don't use fancy things like famously there is the one laptop per child or things like that, which you create a very specific technology for development context. Here we wanted to use just standard smartphone and then develop software on top of them. So you need to kind of think about what the funders are interested in, because they are usually looking for cutting edge technologies or innovation, and to sell the story that the mix of technologies and the process and working between anthropologists and GIS people and computer scientists was the challenge many times, and it continued to be a challenge in different ways. And then getting also different groups of people like computer scientists and anthropologists to talk with one another is another challenge.
That's actually a very interesting opportunity, isn't it? Because they're almost living in completely different universes.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely.
So does the funding, is it academic funding or is it philanthropic funding that you're receiving for this project?
So far, it was mostly academic research funding, and it came from bodies that funding, in one case, it was from the Engineering and Physical Science Research Council, and then it was from another body called the European Research Council, which are aimed at developing interdisciplinary project, which is the fancy word to say when people are coming from completely different areas and trying to make something work together. So that's where the big chunks of funding. There was now emerging a bit of funding that is coming from other sources like foundations, But so far, we didn't have any sort of commercial funding. It was funding that comes, say, from a charity to deliver a specific project or collaboration to deliver a specific activity. And usually it's the application that people want to see. So it's always a struggle to get the funding for the core technology, for the infrastructure, which is common to any infrastructure.
So can you point, have you got examples of sort of what you've achieved with this software in with indigenous communities? I mean, you mentioned the 300 types of tree in the... What else?
Yeah, so in that case, that work that is done in the Maasai Mara and is even merging the thousands of data points that people collected with satellite images and artificial intelligence models in order to understand the landscape, which is a very interesting application of the technology. It's been used by logging companies to work with indigenous groups and identify resources that will be protected from logging. So we're talking about small percentage logging, so not a clear cut, but selective logging. So that's something that you can define an area. Even something that we discuss, you define the location of the forest spirit, and the logging company will just avoid this area and won't get into that. Or, for example, a project with the Zoological Society of London, where for 3 years we've been working with them on monitoring illegal poaching and recording the different location where it happens, and you've got both villagers and hunter-gatherer groups collecting the data.
That's fantastic. So I'm guessing that, because we started off, you said that OpenStreetMap was sort of like the one of the biggest and most high-profile examples of citizen science, you know, 1 million-plus people collecting data. Are you actually able to take the Sapele toolset and take it out into indigenous communities and allow them to actually add to OpenStreetMap?
So we haven't done that. It's one of the ideas that we wanted to do in the future. And one of the issues when you work with indigenous group, and especially when you work with people with low literacy, you have a really big social responsibility on ensuring that the data is protected. And although we follow a whole procedure of kind of thinking about what is right and something called free and prior informed consent, FPIC and community protocol and kind of thinking about the process around the use of the software, you still have issues about what data can be released. So some data is highly sensitive culturally, like what I've just mentioned earlier, you know, the location of certain spirits and other things that are culturally important, whereas other things like the location of the village may be important for humanitarian aspects. So while we haven't done the plumbing in order to connect the data from our data collection to OpenStreetMap, I can see it as something that can happen and should happen at some point with our activities.
I had a guy I used to work with was a near professional wildlife photographer. And he used to go off on trips to sort of the Amazon or wherever, photographing rare species and flora as well. But he used to switch all of his GPS tools off because he said, you know, that he was going into places that not many people went to, and he didn't want to provide the exact location of where species were being identified to sort of avoid the risk of poaching or whatever else might happen to those things if his photos were published. So it is an issue, isn't it? Just understanding how your data could be misused, which I probably hadn't thought about. We're all having to.
And we say that we usually start with the assumption that the data is closed by default, not open by default. Because it's not, and also we think that it's not our data, It belongs to the communities and the people that we work with. And there is a whole sensitivity around indigenous rights and data sovereignty and all kind of other issues. So we're very, very careful about who can see the data and how it can be shared and who you can trust and all the rest of it. It's kind of interesting example of creating something that you know you are holding something precious and you need to really treat it with care.
Absolutely. And I'm getting, just thinking, that culturally it's almost impossible to explain the risks associated with this data that an Indigenous community is creating for you. I mean, it's not like you can say, well, if we release this, such and such might happen, because all of those such and suches are just outside of the sort of remit of understanding that it's reasonable to expect. You know, it's no, you just can't communicate the risks in that regard, can you?
Absolutely spot on. That's really a big thing for us, which is why we now finishing developing something called Sapele Viewer, which is a way to visualize the information that they collected using aerial imagery. So we're using planet data to visualize it. And at least we are planning to use it within those FPIC processes. So people can collect the data and then immediately they'll see the data on a tablet or another device. And that will mean, oh, now I get it. I see right where the data is. So that gets us a little bit, but it's nothing like telling them that someone in Berlin, whichever that place is, is looking at the data because it's available on a cloud server.
But also, I guess, even the concept of a map, laying things out in a sort of some kind of geospatial representation, is challenging to explain.
Yes and no. We discovered a while ago that quite a detailed aerial imagery, the one that where you can identify specific trees and rooftops, anyone in the world can read them. So we've done enough experiment with enough group to know that even people who are illiterate and without any education are capable of reading aerial imagery and make sense of it.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
So what's next? What are you working on next?
Yeah, so
what's coming?
So what next is this kind of thinking about the mapping software and enabling it out. And we're working also with a partner called Natural Aptitude, which is a really interesting company that developed different tools for citizen science, but they're all having some geospatial element. And they will develop a new version of this Sapele so we can offer it with a more robust software that we can roll out and provide to communities and to anyone who wants to use the technology. So we've spent quite a bit of effort to document the process that I talked about. So if you want to use it properly and follow all this community activity, we now have a series of academic but still accessible paper that are offered as open access, so anyone can download and read them, which describe the whole process of how to use the software in the field. There is also now an open access and free book that anyone can download and use to understand how to do the process. And the idea is that now other people can look at our information and the examples and the videos and the guidelines and tutorial and start rolling it out for themselves. So after 10 years, you feel that the process and the software and the concept behind it are robust enough to allow it to start running in the world.
And is it all open? Is the software open source?
Yes. The software is open source. It's based on a data management system called GeoKey, which is also open source. So everything is accessible. We're not using any proprietary stuff, and we're even running it deliberately on Android to ensure that it is indeed completely open.
Wow. Gosh, we've come a long way, haven't we?
Yeah.
When you think of the work you were doing, because I'm just reminded, you know, that when I first met you, you were working on interface design and understanding optimal interfaces. And I think that was partly prompted by the fact that a very popular GIS software product of the time had a highly suboptimal interface, and that most students spent more time learning how to navigate the interface than they did actually learning the techniques of geospatial science.
One of my proudest moments was that in a conference, I think in the AGI conference, I presented a paper, Why Your Boss Should Buy You Two Monitors.
Yes.
As like with the evidence that it's increased productivity. And I remember someone getting in touch and saying they actually showed that to their boss and got two monitors. So that was very pleasing.
Yeah, and obviously that's all come through into developing Sapele, hasn't it? All that experience and understanding. And I think also mobile apps must have made a big difference because they're so much simpler.
Yes, and there is now different options out there. So one of the students in the group is developing a progressive web app that it's also allowing new things to happen and linking into instant messaging. So kind of an app of mapping that allow people to send the link on WhatsApp and kind of share information within the community this way. There are so many things that now can be done. But the learning that are coming out of our research are not just relevant to people who don't read and write. They are relevant for a lot of other things, like the things that I mentioned to you about the ability of people to understand aerial imagery. So we have kind of the basis for developing other applications that are using this understanding in different ways.
Cool. So closing question, which we ask lots of our guests, particularly those who have been regulars at GeoMob, is there a favorite moment from all the GeoMobs that you've attended, the one that you best sums GeoMob up for you?
Interesting. It's actually the pub.
It's the pub.
Yeah,
okay.
Absolutely. The discussion around the pub after GeoMob are the best thing.
Yeah, they are.
That's the kind of, not the presentation, they are all great, and I've seen loads of really fantastic presentations. But when you're starting to have the conversation with people after it, and you're starting to make the connection and catching up and learning about what people are doing and what they're up to, that's the best.
I agree. And I think we just should say, because we talk about going to the pub after GeoMob, it's not about getting a lot of drinks in.
No.
It's just about the fact that you get 40, 50 people standing around, relaxed, able to talk, that makes it such a fantastic event. There's nothing like it.
Yep.
So with that, Mookie, before I say goodbye to you, what I do have to say is it's been a long, long time since you last stood up and talked at GeoMob. You've got all this exciting stuff to talk to us about. So I'm going to put Ed onto you and say you've got to come and speak at the next GeoMob but one, because we're booked out for June, but we'll have one in the autumn and we want to have you there for that.
It will be an absolute pleasure to do that.
Great. Mookie, it's been a pleasure talking to you. I'm in awe of what you've actually achieved, because I sort of touch base with you, you know, not as frequently as we should do, but whenever I touch base with you, I hear the progress that you're making. And I never really got what you were doing. You know, I couldn't really visualize how you were going to get people in the Congo Basin or the Amazon or wherever to actually start using this technology. But actually, it's the most amazing thing that you're doing. And all of us have a debt of thanks to you and your team for what you're doing to make these tools available to people who otherwise would be excluded and disenfranchised. So not only has it been a pleasure, but it's an opportunity to say thank you, my friend.
Thank you very much.
Okay, see you soon. In fact, I'll see you at a GeoMob near you very soon. Take care. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks, everyone, for joining us today and listening to the GeoMob podcast. Hopefully you've enjoyed the discussion. please don't hesitate if you have any feedback for us or any suggestions for topics that we should cover in the future. You can get the show notes over on the website, which is at thegeomob.com. While you're there, if you're not yet on the mailing list, please do get on the mailing list, where we once a month send out an email announcing future events, summarizing past events, and just generally sharing events that you may find of interest. You can also, of course, follow us on Twitter, where our handle is Geomob. You can follow Steven at Steven Feldman. You can follow me at Fryfogle. You can check out Mappery at mappery.org. And of course, if you need any geocoding, please check out my service, which is opencagedata.com. We look forward to you joining us again at a future episode, and of course, seeing you at a future Geomob event. Hope to see you there soon. Bye.